Hello and welcome to episode number 183 of the Chris Knott podcast. Today is another solo episode where we'll be going through functional anatomy, exercises. We're going through presentations, so basically clients coming in with something, and also addressing the or answering the question of the week, which came through via Instagram, where we're asking about hip drop and specifically in females. So yeah, like I said, that if you listen to the previous ones, I want to have it like a structured where the solo ones, you know exactly where you're getting from, where we're talking about anatomy and understanding the functionality of movements. And then again, it allows me to go into a little bit more detail into the exercises that I put up online and on social media. What I've done is, you may have noticed that I've gone with the in-depth descriptions. It's less about the I'm doing it less via the text and the write-up that you can do, and it's more about the main instructions you need to do the exercises. In the previous episode I was talking about the glute ham raise. In this one we're going to talk a little bit more about neck exercises and trap dominance, and then also some work you can do, and a good one which I've been finding really useful, which is the isometric leg press for hinging. Really useful in helping you establish that hinge position. So I'll go through the pros and the cons of that one and things that you need to consider as well. Yeah, and then finally, the question of the week is a really a great one about asymmetry of the pelvis, asymmetry of the hips, and especially in females. A big thing that you want to be considering when it comes to program design. So I'll go through a few factors and things again that we need to consider, and then ways you can address that. So without further ado, I wanted to talk about the pec minor. The reason being is just it leads me in nicely into the whole trap dominance thing and working with clientele. The anatomy of it, if you imagine your scapula, and you can think about your scapula. The scapula has this little hook that projects out called the coracoid process. That little hook is the way I see it, is just like a little projection as a strap. So it actually acts as attachment, which is like a bag strap. So if you can imagine putting the bag that you had at school, you put it over one shoulder, the straps is essentially what the pec minor does. The origin or insertion, if I throw it out there, because I think it can be both, they switch around depending on what the pec minor is doing, and it's going to go into the anterior elements of the ribs 3, 4, 5. So what it does, if we looked at it from a functional anatomy point of view, so basically, not functional, but if we look at it from the Vitruvian man of what it'll say in a textbook, is the pec minor will help elevate the ribs. And it'll help protract the scapula, so help pull the scapula forward as the arm's going forward. Now, when I say the origin and insertion point can switch depending on what it does, that depends on, again, the functionality of how it's being used. Because if the scapula is fixed, so that's the thing that isn't moving, it is a respiratory muscle, because if the coracoid process, so that little hook projection, is staying still, that's going to become the origin. And the insertion point, in terms of the point that it's being pulling on, is going to be the rib cage. And that's a way of elevating the rib cage and creating a pressure change and a change in the expansion of the rib cage at that point in order for a respiration to occur, so in order to breathe. When it goes the other way around, when we're protracting the shoulder, so in essence throwing the shoulder blade forward, then that's when it swaps again. So now the rib cage is the origin and it's pulling the coracoid process or the scapula towards the rib cage. So it depends on which one you're doing. So that's the functional anatomy of it. Now we need to think about how that presents and what that looks like with your typical either desk posture or people, what happens. So if you're thinking about breathing and why is breathing important, it's because to improve our respiration abilities and to improve diaphragmatic breathing, it's going to take the strain off the secondary respiratory or the accessory respiration muscles. Now it's not that you shouldn't use these muscles for breathing. It's not like that in the slightest. And there's a reason why they're called the accessory muscles, because they're contributing to changes in the positions of the chest and the jaw and the neck and everything so that we can breathe. However, when they become overloaded, there becomes an issue here. So if you look at a typical example of someone who's sat at a desk all day, if they're forward, they're in a flexed position, so in spinal flexion, and they have their arms out in front of them, biomechanically, they're going to be naturally shortening the pec minor with both the with the protraction, so the rounding of the shoulders. So if we looked at point A, point B in terms of the coracoid process and the ribs, is that if they're getting closer to one another, then that's going to be a shortening of that. Now, if this person is having a heightened, you know, central nervous system, they've had like lots of coffee, there's lots of stress from work, they're doing shallow breathing, then they don't have any concept of diaphragmatic breathing, is that that pec minor, which is the accessory muscle, is working overtime to help with breathing as well. So when I was saying about, I said last week about using the example of when, you know, when muscles become overloaded, is that when they, when it's in constant, it's constantly being asked to do a job, that can, when the demands on that muscle really increase. So if one position, such as the rounded shoulders and flex position, is shortening it, and so closing the gap from A to B, and then the respiration system, because somebody doesn't know how to diaphragmatically breathe and they have short, shallow breathing, is shortening it from A to B, then the central nervous system is, it can then quietly simply say, well, why don't we chronically shorten this muscle, because that governs or fits in well with what we're doing the most of the time. And again, efficiency is king when it comes to postural positions, is that if we do something long enough, our body will think, well, why don't we just restructure the tissues and lay down some more tissue in certain places, and that'll help us sustain that position with less effort. And that's the kind of law of efficiency type of thing. So the reason why it's important to understand this muscle is because if we have it locked in a concentric manner, then all the things that require an eccentric manner are going to be inhibited. So all the things that are going to be going in the opposite direction, which require the pec minor to be in an eccentric position, are going to be, the movement quality of that, they're going to lead to a compensation, because we can't access that joint position, and or we're not going to efficiently be able to move it. Now, when we're doing something like a row, or when we're going for extension of the shoulder, which is very important for rotation, so it's very important for torso rotation, we need shoulder extension movement to assist that global movement of late phase torso rotation in stance phase of gait, is that we've kind of shut down that process. And what that basically means is that when we're doing an exercise where we are, where we're trying to access that joint position, so again, shoulder extension, is this pec minor being constantly concentrically contracted is going to inhibit that. So if you can imagine any exercise where the elbow is going behind the body, so where the elbow is passing the rib cage, such as a dip, such as a decline press, such as a row where you're looking in to let it hit the shortened range of the muscle, if somebody's posture and breathing is keeping the pec minor short, is that they're not going to allow the scapular position, we're not going to be able to access the scapular position in order to do that effectively. Therefore, we have to drive a compensation. Now, when it comes to driving a compensation, one of the things that we may do is try and create more space in the glenohumeral capsule, so basically the shoulder joint. And the way we can do that is if we elevate the scapula, so put them into more upward rotation, we can point the upper arm bone, so the humerus, in a position which gives us this kind of quote-unquote artificial shoulder extension. But the problem with this is we've then shortened the upper trapezius muscles, so we're getting this neck and trap dominance. So it's never that there's one muscle that's really, really important and that governs it. And as when I spoke about last week about the TFL, it's not that the TFL is the lock and key. It's just that these small muscles are going to contribute to the positioning of joints, and the positioning of joints is what helps us get the most efficient way of accessing the big muscles. So even though these things, you know, such as breathing may seem very holistic or more to do with like yoga and low intensity things, is that biomechanically speaking, if we don't address them, then we're not going to be able to get someone or ourselves as strong and as big as we want to. And this is the thing when it comes to your average personal training client, so anybody who works at a desk job and does a lot of office work, is that by programming like a dip or programming like a row where you're saying, right, we're going to focus and hit the lats, then you're essentially taking it as a given that this person has the perfect mechanics in order to achieve that position. And personally, the way I see it is that you can't fully stimulate the upper fibers, so the proximal fibers of the lats, without being able to achieve a downward rotation position of the scapula, which again is driven by torso rotation. So if that pec minor is chronically shortened, you're going to inhibit your ability to properly effectively load the lat, and that can again impact muscle development. So this could, you know, you may be thinking, right, okay, that's great, but how do we address this? And first of all, education on breathing has to be the first one, because it's not that, you know, if somebody's been breathing like this for 20 or 30 years that, you know, we'll just teach them a few nasal inhalations, it goes away. It's more about the education throughout all aspects of life. So stress management, looking at obviously breathing as a factor, looking at ways to reduce the perception of stress, looking at the duration of the length of posture or time at the desk as well, and just looking for exacerbating factors. And as well as this, it's like, as we've done this, but then in our program, are we doing things beforehand which are either going to improve the situation or make it worse? So there was, again, if you go on social media, one, I was talking about the shoulder protractions and the movement and the breathing behind that one. And the specific breathing was, as you're going forward, you're going to inhale, and as you go backwards, you're going to exhale. Now, the reason for doing that is that placing the dumbbell in that specific position and having your arm out, that's going to create a challenge to the medial and posterior fibers of the deltoid. By using respiration, it acts as a flossing movement in the rib cage in order to match what we're actually doing. Now, the reason why I was shortening the muscle as I protracted my shoulder forward is that if we hypothesize, remember, this is a hypothesis based on a model that I believe is true, is as you go into protraction and you inhale, if we've hypothesized that the pec minor is an inhalation muscle because it helps us breathe in, and it's a protraction muscle, then if we match all three of those components, so inhalation, protraction, and pushing the scapula forward, elevation of the rib cage, then we're getting it to do everything it should do. Then if we exhale and eccentrically lengthen that muscle, so in other words, retract the shoulder blade and rotate slightly backwards whilst exhaling, we're then teaching it how to inhibit and go eccentrically. So we're essentially training that motion. So if you've got somebody who is struggling to access the late phases of rotation in the shoulder or shoulder extension, we need to unlock the scapula. And to unlock the scapula, we basically need to move it around. So that's a very, very important process. But if we can do that, integrating it with certain breathing exercises and certain positions, is going to help a lot. And this takes me very nicely into the trap dominant side of things, because when people say they are the trap dominant, or they constantly feel it in their traps, that is essentially the inability of the scapula to properly move around the thoracic region in the spine. So somewhere there's going to be an inhibition. Now you need to look at, why are the muscles that attach to the scapula locked up? And it is going to be from a respiration point of view, because if we can't breathe properly, we're going to hold ourselves in the position as a way of biomechanically assisting with breathing. So if we do this, it's not like just because we're doing a bodybuilding exercise, and even if the external mechanics are perfect, so even if you've set this exercise up perfectly, that still doesn't mean that we're suddenly, the body's going to go, well, this is exercise for the lat, so I'm going to use my lat. It's just going to go with the range of motion and joint freedom that it has. So if it doesn't have that, it's obviously going to overload tissues. If it overloads tissues, it's just going to be the ones which resort to the default pattern. So if somebody has this method by which the traps are constantly constantly tense for whatever reason, is that that's going to lead to them not being able to move, which again, if we're talking about the movement and where the load is distributed, it's not through the right areas. So this is where you'll start to see that this whole thing behind, like, why can I feel my traps when doing when I'm doing a row or doing a press or when I'm doing a lateral raise, it's really down to respiration quality. It's down to stress, and it's down to how much the scapula can move and freedom of movement in the thoracic. And we've got to look at all these different factors. Now, then you can go down the holistic route and saying, is there anything in my lifestyle apart from these biomechanical factors which are contributing to increased stress perception? So this is such like alcohol, caffeine intake, and so forth. Stress with work, stress, you know, emotional stress. So again, we're looking at the big picture, because I know it's looking at everything from, very, very broad, but this is where understanding the triggers of what sets off either anxiety or stress-induced situations can actually inhibit your training as well. So it's that awareness of how everything contributes to everything, which is really, really key. So with trap dominance, if you have somebody and they're really, really struggling to feel movements such as chest, such as lats, look at their breathing and look at the quality of their breathing. If that's not good, then go for that. If they're still having an issue and their breathing is good and they know how to diaphragmatically breathe, look at the frequency in which they are stimulating the scapula to move. And that's, if they've got a desk job or something, you may think that they go and see you in the gym for 2 or 3 hours a week, but, for the rest of 40, 50 hours, if not more, they're sat in a hunched position and there's that build up. And the body's not stupid. If there's no need for it to do something, then it won't do it. And it's, it's that use it or lose it principle, which if we don't stimulate joints and tissues to move, then they don't know how to do it from the central nervous system's point of view, but they also don't get the nutrition and fluidity and the production of synovial fluid. So it's very, very, very important that we address this. So moving on to the not exercise of the week, but something that I put up yesterday being 25th of October, it was the leg press isometric. And this idea occurred to me when actually demonstrating an exercise to a client and talking them through how to make a leg press a lot more glute dominant. And we were just dispelling the myth that a wide stance is better for the glutes, which it 100% isn't. And when I was going through this, I didn't actually lift the weight. I was just demonstrating it. And then it occurred to me, I was like, this is quite interesting. So essentially, when we're looking at exercises, it's very, very important to understand that the joint range of motion or where a joint is going to reflect how a muscle works. And then we can play around with directions of force and direction of gravity, but essentially we're still working a joint position and pattern. And with the leg press, what I noticed is that the position that I was in terms of the level of hip flexion and what I was trying to do in terms of creating hip extension pretty much recreated the exact same position of the starting point for my deadlift position, which is you need to be able to access a level of hip flexion in order to get your hips low into a point where you can find the biting point. And when I say finding the biting point, it's that sweet spot where you can get some contraction in the glutes, properly load the glutes and push the floor away and feeling like you're doing it via hip extension and not back extension or basically extension through the lumbar spine. And that can be very, very tricky. But what I was able to do as well is because you're in a safe position where there's no loading going through the spine, is that you can really push into, and if you use an isometric contraction and then match the breathing to that position, you can essentially get this very, 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 very slight change in pelvic position through respiration, which will make getting into hip flexion a lot easier. And the way this works is when we breathe in, breathe out, there'll be a change on the pelvis. And when we match it to a certain breathing position, if we can create external stimulus or external loading, we can then recreate the position that we're trying to achieve. And in this one, it was more internal rotation of the inanimate bone in the pelvis. That's going to change the position of the sacrum. And what will happen is if you integrate this into your warm-ups, you'll slowly be able to access hip flexion even more. So if you've ever gone in to do a deadlift and you go down, you think, fuck, your lower back's rounding, or you feel tight, or you feel like, oh, that just feels horrible, then this is very, very effective because we're essentially using the muscles on the outside of the body to reshape the ones on the inside. And what you can do is by putting the emphasis through the heels and creating a 90 degree angle between the heel and the plate and creating the same level of hip flexion that you want for the deadlift, if you put those two together and really emphasize this and breathe out and let your knees fall in, which is very important, you do want your knees falling, not so they knock knees and go together and they've massively gone in towards each other, but just so they are moving into the line of levels of the big toe and your feet are pointing parallel, so it's not 10 and 2 and your feet aren't pointed out, they're pointing as if you were walking forwards. If you're to do that and match that with the exhalations, you're going to make this a lot easier to access that hip flexion. So you can do this for anywhere to 3 to 4 reps, and then you go in back and forth in between your warm-up sets and just see how that feels. But the pros of this is obviously you get more, I don't want to use the word glute activation because it's not the right word, but glute awareness. You're matching the pelvic position to a level of hip flexion that you want. You're then able to get a smoother deadlift position. And as a byproduct, you should be able to recruit your glutes or basically make your body more aware of your glutes when doing the deadlift position. Now, the cons I would say is that you're not getting any stimulus through the spinal loading or teaching the midsection how to deal with the spine. But if you were to integrate this with something like a kneeling plank or some form of static position where you're actually loading the lumbar spine, then we've got this perfect circuit of warm up with the deadlift, isometric leg press, and then doing some form of spinal stabilization drill. Even if it's something like a single arm kettlebell carry, that'll work as well. But the main thing is you want to set up the leg press to a position where your level of hip flexion matches the level that you want with the deadlift. If you can't do that because the leg press, you know, the back of the seat doesn't move or the positioning is challenging, then this could be a challenging thing to do. So it is very much down to the quality of the leg press and how you can set this up, because it may be that you need to take it off the runners because it's not the right distance and therefore it becomes a lot more challenging. And it's not that I would say that there's anything, well, it's doing leg presses, so actually doing the movement beforehand will warm them up. It was just more so that you're trying to replicate the exact point where you break the bar from the ground. And if you can make that more comfortable to your central nervous system in your body, then naturally you're going to be able to do it at a greater extent. So I've tried this out a couple of weeks and I just really like it. It just feels a lot smoother and it just feels so much more body awareness to the glutes and feel like you're really, really pushing and hip extending that bar away from the floor rather than just pulling through your lumbar spine. So I really like that one, hence why I put it up. Obviously, be careful with it. There's pros and cons behind every exercise. And, you know, if you have any form of, you know, spinal or low back issues, do be careful before taking any advice from anyone on the internet without fully being screened or assessed first. Okay, so final question is talking about assessing hip drop. So I had a question basically saying about how a female client postnatal, they noticed that when doing lunges or when doing split squats, one side of the pelvis is just dropping in and falling to one side. And it's really difficult to address and to notice. And it's such a common one. And like, I really do think that pelvic asymmetries are more common than uncommon. And it's very, very, it's just a normal factor of life. I do think we are asymmetrical. We're not symmetrical by any stretch of the imagination. People always come to me and say, I feel twisted, I feel rotated, I feel this, I feel that. And I think that's completely normal. It's just the way in which we manage these things and the how smart we are with the training which comes into this. If you think about if we are twisted, which pretty much everyone is, and then we add load to this, we're just going to increase that level of twist, if that makes sense. So that's the one thing about weight training, is that that's why counteracting twisting movements, rotational movements, unilateral movements, and looking at the mechanics from one side to the other are so important. If we never do that, then we can exacerbate these issues, which is why people get the problem. But with assessing hip drop, essentially, women are always going to favor one side. It makes complete sense. And I think a few years ago, I called this the flamingo theory, where you're always going to just shift your body weight onto one leg, straighten that leg, and then it becomes a lot more efficient way of distributing your body weight, especially if you've got a child on your hip, especially if you've got heavy bags. And what happens here is that you're going to increase the rigidity over time. So you may only be holding this position for like 30 minutes to 60 minutes a day, but do that for years and years and then add the load of a child on the hip. That's going to basically ingrain and, if you use a better word, squish the joints in that position. So then what's happening is that we've altered the mechanics from one side to the other, which is going to impact the way that the joints move within each other. So it may be, and this is where it kind of gets a little bit complicated, but it's not if you think about it, is that if something doesn't move on one side, so let's just say someone's left hip is very, very restricted because they always load the left hip, is that the opposite side may gain a little bit of mobility in order to accommodate for the lack of movement in that side. So this is where, if we go by the concept of when something is rigid, something else will increase mobility. And unfortunately, that's not always the case. Sometimes something else may increase rigidity as well. But let's just say in this case it has, is that that increase in mobility will probably present as an instability. So in other words, wobbling. So if somebody's hip is dropping, one side is going to need stability, so to learn how to control force and keep stable, and the other side is going to need mobility. So with a hip drop, it's pretty sure that you'll find something in either the hip or the foot, which is very restricted. So it's down to finding that in the client is where is the restriction and how do you improve that? If the feet are mobile and the hips are mobile, then it might be in the SI joint or the lumbar spine, but it's more likely going to be somewhere. But essentially, what you want to do, if it was just, what do I do, rather than trying to dissect the body and find things which are very intricate, which may be challenging and may reduce the intensity of the session, is that in this case, you want to identify a position in which somebody starts to show this issue, so they start to show the problem that they've got, and stop them at that point. I'm going to cough, so one second. So if somebody has a change in one side where it's kicking out to the side, you'd want to recreate an exercise where just as they start to present with that shift, they stop, pause, and learn how to contract those muscles. Then if you think about it, the side that they're falling into, they need to be able to try and absorb force to push it back. So think of it like a trampoline. So therefore, if you want to do something, you want to do something static and enduring, and then dynamic, which is going to help them in a dynamic model. So this would be, say someone's hip, the hip that's kicking out to the side and it's dropping out to the side, you do something static such as a side plank, where you're really trying to get them to breathe into the area which is unstable, and then you do something dynamic, let's say like side lunges, going from not necessarily Cossack squats, but where you're doing lateral lunges, but doing it very gently, where you're teaching them how to inhale and absorb force as they kick to the side. And doing those together, you're hitting both sides of learning how to absorb force and learning how to hold that position. So it's maintenance of position and using it in a dynamic model. And the thing is that even though this may not be like, oh, you're not, I'm not doing a leg press, I'm not doing a squat, I'm not doing a deadlift, is that you've got to look at this long term. If somebody has a structural issue with you and you don't address it, it's very likely that at some point it'll cause an issue to the point where it's either knee, lower back, or foot or ankle, which means they can't train with you. If someone can't train with you, they can't get the results. But if they have this biomechanical issue as well, it means that the exercise you're doing aren't going to be as accurate for loading the tissues. So I'm not saying everything everybody being perfectly structurally balanced, because we've already established that doesn't exist. But it's important that there's something in your program which addresses these restrictions and imbalances and problems, so that that we manage the situation. And then the level of emphasis you put on it depends on the symptoms that someone has. So if they have like noticeable pain or noticeable restrictions or noticeable instabilities, you need to increase the volumes of stuff that addresses that. If they're not, and they're training really, really well, and they're training really heavy, they've got no issues, they're growing muscle tissue, there's no complaints, then you're in the best of interest to maximize this and strike while the iron's hot. That being said, you do always need something in their program week. It may not be with you, but it may be with stuff that you get them to do on their own at home or in another gym, in another training session in the gym that addresses it. Because we should never get cocky with instabilities and issues, is that we should always stay on top of these factors. And the more we stay on top of these factors through diligent training and looking at all types of movement patterns, the better that we're going to be in terms of being able to do the movements and train in the gym as much as we want. So reiterating with the hip drop is this, it's identifying the instability and recreating exercises which address it, and then integrating it back into the movement that you noticed where there was an issue, and then seeing how the person responds. But again, a lot of this with women is going to be down to asymmetrical pelvic floor issues, which again goes down to breathing, which is why this is that's a foundational. So pelvic floor contractions and management and breathing is one of the first things that you can do. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to go through like these, breathing to here, line your back, do this, because we do appreciate that people are busy and they do want to train. But you can educate the people on how to do this, join the exercises by setting up, taking the time and cueing them properly. Now, I do believe that every client should always finish the exercise and say to you, wow, I could really feel that in and then it should be the target muscle that you said. That's not always going to be the time, and you might get some odd ones here and there, but they should finish every set and go, wow, that fill the blank muscle is absolutely torched, and that's what we're searching for. And you know, if that's not happening on each set, you've got to ask yourself why, because that means there's a lack of efficiency. Lack of efficiency is going to lead to a lack of results with you know, muscle development. Cool. Okay, I'll wrap it up there. I'll give you the latest on future projects. APX level 1 is almost there. I was going to go for a mid-November release. However, this is very, very much something, it's a huge, huge passion project of mine, and I don't want to rush it. It will be out, you know, in the not too distant future. It's not like it's going to be too long, but I want to make sure it can get certified. I want to make sure it's as best as I possibly can do in terms of the content and the structure. And I want to do some trials to make sure there's ways of people being able to understand it. And if there's any issues, then that's ironed out before it goes live. But in the not too distant future, again, there'll be this. Membership site is coming as well for people who want to know a lot more about movement mechanics, anatomy, and program design. That will be coming soon in the future. Until then, in order to help you with any of the mobility issues that you may have, I have been working on the APX YouTube channel, which currently has about 10 videos up, which will be 20 by the end of this week, just on some movement explanations, joint health, how to mobilize. And I want to keep them short and snappy. So they're short and snappy videos, so you can send them to your clients, you can use them yourself, and it'll just say what they do. And it's all about joint health and movement to keep you as fit and healthy as you can. So yeah, YouTube channel is up and running. Membership is up, going to be not too distant future. Course is written, just want to get that ironed out so it's absolutely perfect. So that's on its way. If you have any questions that you'd like to ask me, or any, you know, any topics, or you say I've got a client who has this, or I have you know, I have this issue myself, you want me to discuss that in further detail, feel free to you know, message me on Instagram. You can email me chris@apxed.com as well. Other than that, thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful rest of your day.